Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. When we talk about love and matters of the heart, we tend to ask philosophical questions or rhetorical ones. What is love? What is love? Helen Fisher wanted a scientific answer. She's a biological anthropologist who had long been fascinated with this topic. Specifically, she wanted to see love in the brain. Another researcher told her that was a bad idea.
You can't study love. It's part of the supernatural. And I looked at that and I said, my goodness, you know, fear isn't part of the supernatural. Anger isn't part of the supernatural.
Helen was sure love would show up in a scan.
It has to be somehow in the brain.
She and her team did brain scans of people who were in love while they were looking at a picture of that special someone. And she was right. There was a part of the brain that would light up.
You know, I was thrilled. I remember where I was sitting. I remember what I was wearing. it was one of those great moments in life. I felt as if I had snuck into Mother Nature's kitchen and found one of our recipes for one of the most profound of all human experiences, which is romantic love.
But where the brain was lighting up surprised her.
I thought I was going to see a lot of activity in emotion centers of the brain, but I didn't. I found activity in a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area, or the VTA, way below the cortex where you do your thinking, but in basic regions linked with drive. It makes dopamine, and dopamine is a natural stimulant, and that's what gives you that energy and the euphoria and the optimism and the focus and the motivation of intense romantic love.
This was close to a brain area that orchestrates other basic desires.
Thirst and hunger. Thirst and hunger keep you alive today, but romantic love drives you to form a partnership and drive your DNA into tomorrow.
So it's much like thirst and hunger keeping us alive. There's this area that says, go, 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 find that person, fall in love.
Exactly.
Procreate.
Yeah. We have evolved really three different brain systems that work on this together. Sex drive gets you out there looking for a whole range of people. You can have sex when you're not in love with somebody. Romantic love enables you to focus your mating energy on just one person at a time. And that third brain system of attachment enables you to stick with this person at least long enough to raise a single child through infancy, about 4 years. So I think that these three brain systems work together. And in a very good relationship, you have all three. You want to make love to your partner. You feel romantic towards your partner, at least some of the time. And you feel also a profound feelings of deep attachment.
Since Helen did her first brain studies on love in 2005, there's been a lot more research on this topic. And online dating sites have turned finding love into a science on a whole new level. On today's episode, we're exploring what researchers are learning about this emotion and all the joy and pain it can bring. Let's start with the pain. So the first line in that Hathaway song is, what is love? But everybody knows what comes right after that.
Baby, don't hurt me.
Don't hurt me
no more.
When love goes wrong, it can be incredibly painful.
I just thought I was insane. Like, I thought I had lost my mind.
I couldn't even get away from it when I was asleep. I would still dream about the same things and wake up and then have to live my day feeling like that too.
It was on my mind all the time and like just on my heart heavily all the time.
And when you're in the throes of that pain, it's hard to picture a way out. We would give anything for relief. Reporter Jad Slayman looked into the science of heartache and whether there's hope for a cure.
You can learn a lot about love and heartbreak from voles. They look a bit like a cross between a mouse and a hamster, and they're monogamous. Most animals are not.
In mammals, only about 5% of species form these long-term bonds. It's kind of rare.
Larry Young studies voles at his Emory University lab to understand the neurobiology behind social behavior. Voles have something like love, and it's very cute.
Within a day after they mate, they prefer to spend their time just sitting next to each other, touching each other. What we call huddling, facing in the same direction and perfectly still.
Their version of heartbreak is also kind of cute, but also desperately sad.
A vole that is bonded or has been with a partner and then the partner has been taken away. If you put them in a beaker of water for a few minutes, it tends to just float. If you hold them up by their tail, they just hang there. They show the signs of despair.
They just give up on life, basically. It's not worth it without her. But for voles, at least, there is a cure for a broken heart.
Oxytocin.
It's a naturally occurring hormone.
If at the moment that the partner goes away, we infuse a little bit of oxytocin into the brain, it's as if they never lost their partner at all.
Back to carefree bachelor voles. Lots of mammals produce oxytocin, including humans.
When a mother is getting ready to have birth, her brain releases oxytocin. It goes to the uterus. The uterus begins to contract, and that's what labor is.
Then, after delivery, oxytocin boosts the salience of the mother's perception of her newborn. It's like taking a fuzzy TV signal and turning it to 4K.
And that causes the brain to pay very close attention to the details, the smells, the face, all the different little attributes of the baby.
It's all brilliant and beautiful. Even the ugliest babies are gorgeous in their mother's eyes. They bond. And the same oxytocin hormone is produced by dad as well.
You're such a cutie pie.
Turns out in a few species that have evolved monogamy, or this pair bonding, the same molecule that is causing other mothers to bond with their babies are now causing the parents to bond with each other.
Oxytocin is the first of three chemicals that essentially create love. There's also dopamine, the feel-good, cocaine-y neurotransmitter, and vasopressin, another hormone. In animals like voles and humans that form monogamous bonds, these three have matching receptors in the addiction centers of the brain. Those depressed, floating voles, the ones hanging listlessly by their tails, they're in withdrawal. It's because of a stress hormone, CRF.
It really gets loaded when the animals form a bond, but it's not released. It's just loaded, like loading a gun. But then when they are away from their partner, that CRF floods into the brain.
And this CRF stops oxytocin production cold. Larry thinks it's maybe a naturally evolved kind of insurance policy. Animal mates, voles, and human have to spend time apart to forage for seeds or go to class or whatever. That CRF is part of what bums you out, makes you miss the other person and go back to them to get another fix of oxytocin.
Just like a heroin junkie or a cocaine junkie, when they go without their drug for a little while, they get a negative affect that brings them back to the drug.
So in voles, you can replace the drug, infuse oxytocin into the brain, and they're fine. But for humans, that doesn't really work. It's a more complicated problem. It's why Larry is careful to say bonds or bonding when talking voles. He doesn't call what they have love.
I think that love probably is fairly uniquely human, and that is our cortical capacity, our intellectual capacity, not only to feel that strong drive, but to really speak the language of romance. To think about the future, to think about abstract things.
Other animals experience the addiction, the drive of bonding. We humans make it into what Larry calls love by applying meaning to it. And we apply meaning to heartbreak too.
We are also uniquely equipped to replay and ruminate on negative feelings over and over and over again.
That's Ethan Cross. He runs the Emotion and Self-Control Lab at the University of Michigan.
This process of turning over in your mind over and over and over again that negative experience, that can become a toxic process.
Thinking about how badly things had ended and how it could have gone differently.
To try to figure out when I messed up or like what I did that would make him not want to be with me.
Rumination has real health impacts. Everything from cardiovascular health to accelerated aging, because it's essentially chronic stress.
This really is how stress gets under the skin and hurts us, right? Like a stress reaction isn't bad per se. It's when we are experiencing stress chronically over and over and over and over again.
Ethan says heartbreak is a uniquely insidious stress response because it invites that replaying of events. If only I'd said this instead of that, how could I miss that sign? So to study heartbreak, he and his team designed an experiment that's kind of messed up.
And I should preface all of this to say that, this sounds like we're torturing people. We're doing this stuff to learn more about how emotions and pain works to ultimately help people.
He put up posters seeking heartbroken individuals for brain study.
It was not hard to find participants with that ad in New York City.
About 40 of them.
They, on the whole, were quite jovial until they participated in the task, and that's where things turned a little bit less jovial.
The task? Look at pictures of your ex. Think about them. Think about the breakup.
So how did you feel in the precise moment where this other person told you they no longer want to be in a relationship with you?
This all happens as brain scans are being taken. The team also applies thermodes to each participant's skin. A thermode is basically a piece of metal that you can heat up electrically.
The sensation is akin to holding a hot cup of coffee from Starbucks without the sleeve, that protective sleeve that's on it.
It hurts, but doesn't harm you. They saw activity in the same brain region with both the hot metal and the ex's Instagram.
And so if I pinch you, these parts of your brain becoming active, they're registering physical pain. Those were also active when people were experiencing social pain, thinking about a broken relationship.
He found love hurts, like physically. That was in 2011. Over the years, his lab has found a few ways to make it hurt less. Pay attention, lonely listeners. Up first, there's time travel.
Mental time travel.
Time heals all wounds, and Ethan says you can kind of speed it up in your head.
Telling people to imagine how they would feel in a year from now, rather than think about how they feel right now, that in itself is a little mental hack, if you will, psychological hack that can help improve the way people feel. It's called temporal distancing.
Another strategy is to talk about the breakup like it's happening to someone else, which kind of makes sense. Other people's breakups always seem melodramatic, right? Ethan says it's easy to think that way when it's not your breakup, when you didn't suffer what he calls the emotional assault.
When we experience those kinds of traumas or assault, and assault isn't a bad way to think about it, it's an emotional assault, our attention narrows. So we devote our resources on a problem, just like if we were going to battle and someone attacked us, we would devote all of our forces towards warding off that attack. When we're rejected, our attention zooms in, it narrows in on that problem, on that experience.
You get stuck in this attacked experience. Ethan calls it immersion. So you can't see, for instance, that there's plenty of fish in the sea. He hopes his research helps shift how we think about social pain, like heartbreak, and it seems to be working. I spoke with Guy Winch about this. He's a psychologist in New York, and he mentioned some of Ethan's research.
I think that when I asked therapists, how many of you got any training whatsoever on this condition?
This condition being heartbreak.
And what to do about it, no one did, and I didn't either. It's just not something we cover in schools, even though it's extremely common and extremely dramatic.
Guy's been working on filling that gap. He wrote a book about it, How to Fix a Broken Heart. He dove into the literature, looked for research like Ethan's and others, anything that touched on heartbreak. He learned about the physical pain of it, the ways it resembles and works like addiction. And to him, heartbreak also seemed quite a lot like grief.
Just in terms of what it looks like phenomenologically, it's a form of grief. It's what you see in other forms of grief and loss, whether you're losing a relative or a spouse or a partner.
But he calls heartbreak a kind of disenfranchised grief. Even though it's like a loved one dying, even though it works like addiction, and even though it straight up physically hurts, we don't take it seriously.
So it's disenfranchised in that it's not something when if you have a relationship with somebody for 3 years, but you're not married and you're a 40-year-old executive, you're not going into work and saying to your boss or calling in and saying, I need a couple of days off, my boyfriend left me. It's just not a career move you would make. And yet you might not be able to function at all.
So part of the cure for a broken heart, he says, is taking heartbreak seriously. He tells patients they're not crazy when considering a cross-country last-ditch mission to get her back. They're in the throes of addiction. And that they're not acting like angsty teens when they can't go into the office without crying. They're grieving. He tells them this will pass. They'll find someone else, someone just as good, probably better.
In other words, you're not grieving Mr. or Mrs. Perfect. You're not grieving the perfect relationship that was happiness and bliss from morning till night, because that, A, doesn't exist. Certainly, if that were the case, then there wouldn't have been a breakup.
Larry Young, the guy who cures vole heartbreak with oxytocin infusion, he told me finding someone new, a new Mrs. or Mr. Perfect, is probably the best cure for humans, the old rebound.
Identify another partner that is going to start the whole process over again of releasing dopamine and oxytocin, and that's going to help sort of rewrite those neural circuits.
He knows from experience, after his first marriage fell apart, he was like one of his voles, floating listlessly in a beaker, too sad to swim.
I lived in a house with no furniture. I had like a lawn chair and a $25 television set, and I was devastated.
Then enter her.
She studied the neural circuitry of male sexual behavior in rats.
He studied vole mating, she studied rat mating. Typical will they, won't they. It was at a conference in Italy.
It was just a romantic kind of thing, right? Capri's a small little island, and there's the Blue Grotto and all these beaches with these nice rocks and everything.
The two of them pair bonded one night, as Larry put it, and they've been happily married since 2004. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
You're listening to The Science of Love, a special production from The Pulse. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mike and Scott. One of the reasons heartbreak hurts is because there's usually that sense that this relationship was meant to be. It was meant to last. I asked researcher Helen Fisher about that.
Do you have any thoughts on why we always think this is the one? Like recently, I was looking back for this show. I was looking back through little things I wrote about some boy in high school or whatever. And it seemed like at the time it felt like, but he's the one and this is it.
And we've all been there.
And then when you look back, it makes you laugh.
Yeah, but at the time, what was I thinking?
Right. But at the time, it wasn't funny. Yet again, we show up for this love thing, right?
Well, I think there's a real reason for that in the brain. There's this great, huge brain region linked with just remembering the negative. And when you're madly in love with somebody, activity in that brain region reduces. It's called positive illusions. And you overlook what you don't like about the person and just focus on what you do. And there's other brain regions in the prefrontal cortex, right, the area right behind your forehead, linked with decision-making and judgment, and activity in those brain regions also reduces when you're madly in love. So you can overlook incredible things. You can say, oh, well, he's married, but he's going to get a divorce. Oh, he's just had a baby with somebody else. Well, that's not a problem. You can overlook incredible things. Bottom line is we're capable of self-deception. And probably even some of that self-deception evolved so that we could get on with the process of falling in love, forming a partnership, and sending that DNA into tomorrow. So it's actually probably an adaptive thing that as a teenager you thought this guy was cool.
Coming up, you could call it a crush or maybe an obsession, or maybe you're just losing it a little bit.
When he was messaging me, you get those physical manifestations. You're making it something bigger than it is. You're like, oh my God, and you're rereading and rereading it.
Some researchers call this feeling limerence. Hey boy, that's still to come.
Boy? You're trying to play coy like a game boy. Hit my phone, boy. Is your home, boy? Are you a lone boy? Come give me dome, boy. Got a boy with degrees, a boy in the streets, a boy on his knees. He a man in the sheets. Sheesh, it's all Greek to me. Got this boy speaking Spanish. I hit my beard.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about love and what science can tell us about it. Let's say you have a new crush, a serious one. Sometimes those feelings can spin out of control. You're checking your phone obsessively. Is there a new message? You do things you would never do otherwise. You go very long distances to be with this person.
So I once rode 35 hours on a Greyhound bus from Philly to Pensacola, Florida.
We were hanging out on South Street and drinking, and I drew us a tattoo in an alleyway, and then we went and got it tattooed on our hips.
I decided to move to Seattle from Washington, D.C.
And I said, let's meet in Paris for Valentine's Day. So we spent 48 hours in Paris.
One time I climbed through the barracks window to be able to stay over the night. Yeah, I don't know if that's romantic or extremely illegal.
And so I dropped out of college. And I never went back.
This feeling can be all-consuming, a little bit crazy, maybe because it is. What is this obsession? Grant Hill looked into it.
Alexa Panalitis was in college, in undergrad, and taking a writing class when it happened.
It was a small class of like 12 kids, and my teacher made us go around the room and introduce ourselves. And then when he, you know, had to give like a 2-minute introduction of himself in class, his voice, the way he sounded, just everything seemed like really attractive.
Alexa had a boyfriend at the time, but soon the attractive guy in her class was taking up more and more of her headspace. She'd show up late to try to arrive at the classroom at the same exact time as him. Then they got partnered up to peer review each other's work.
When he was messaging me, you know, you get those physical manifestations. You're making it something bigger than it is. You're like, oh my God, and you're rereading it and rereading it. And those words are embedded in your head. I mean, years later, I can still word for word tell you what those messages said.
She and her boyfriend ended up breaking up. Partly, she says, because of her infatuation with the other guy.
He started to define my experiences, even though we weren't even in a relationship. He was not my boyfriend.
Psychotherapist Evie Bentley uses a specific term for this feeling, limerence.
Limerence is passionate love and adoration for another, where the attachment was involuntary. There's a strong need to make sense and a story out of this attachment.
I told Alexa about limerence.
Oh my God, like there's a word for this?
The term limerence was coined by psychologist Dorothy Tenov in 1979, and it's way more than a crush. It's an infatuation, an obsession. Here's Evie again.
The extra thing is that that poor person experiencing this experiences great mood swings between elation when they think have received confirmation that the passion is returned, and utter despair when they do usually recognize that this is all fantasy.
Evie has co-authored a study and a book about limerence and says that while the experience of limerence shares many commonalities with obsessive compulsive disorder, she believes it's time for limerence to be officially recognized by the psychiatric community.
It's sufficiently different from the OCD classification. I believe it should be a separate thing. It should be acknowledged that this exists.
People can experience limerence with someone they know, have just met, or have simply seen in a movie or TV show. Often, limerence involves believing that love is being reciprocated, just covertly.
There is this very faulty thinking about ordinary, everyday things that are being interpreted wrongly. They interpret everyday signs, signals, behaviors as special, secret, passionate communication from this other person.
Your crush takes milk in their coffee? So do you. They like David Bowie? So do you. Or even weirder things.
So if it's a woman or a man who walks past your house and they happen to stumble slightly, if they glance at the building or a tree or look sideways, it's a sign to you. It's a special sign to you because you're special, because they return your adoration and they're just showing you that they return it and that they are planning for the day when you will be together. It's not like anything else.
For Alexa, our student in love, or limerence, she stayed obsessed with her crush. They were hanging out more and going on cool dates. Well, at least she thought they were dates.
And then one day, we were hanging out at his house after seeing like a movie or something like that. And he was leaving and we were joking and he's like, this is why I keep you around. And I'm like, wait a second, huh? Like, why you keep me around? I was like, wait, do you want to talk about that? And I was kidding.
But he wasn't.
And then I came out and I said, I was like, well, do you see this going anywhere? And he was like, and he was like, no. And then he was like, well, it's not you. If I liked anyone, it would be you. But I just don't. That's just not where I am. And so I went downstairs and I ran to my best friend's house crying. I was like, I don't know. This is so overwhelming and weird. And like just everything I was dreaming about and thinking about for months, it was just like thrown in your face.
So how does one get over limerence?
That is the difficult question. How to recover? The strategies, the main one, which is really hard, called starvation. So if you can, you starve yourself of the object of your adoration, but it is so hard because your life is organized around searching for this person, watching them or listening to them.
Luckily for Alexa, she and her crush relocated soon after breaking it off. She was starved of his presence by default. And now she dates someone else who she can be open about this experience with, which, according to Evie, helps.
People feel a release from being able to talk frankly and openly about something that they do realize ain't gonna happen.
Alexa says she and her new boyfriend have a lot of trust, and she feels bad about the guy she dated while she was in the throes of limerence with her college crush.
It was very, very bad. X, if you're hearing this, I am so sorry.
That story was reported by Grant Hill. We're talking about love and what science is learning about this emotion. So when your crush feels zero limerence for you, and when he texted, see you later, it was just a friendly sign-off and not a promise for a hot date, it sounds like finding somebody else is the best cure. And where do you find that somebody else? Online, of course.
More people are dating on the internet now than meeting through friends. It seems to be the primary way to meet new people.
That's Helen Fisher again. She is a biological anthropologist and a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute. And she says, yes, online dating is new, but it's not revolutionary.
Technology is always changing courtship. I mean, when you think about it, when the automobile came in, late 40s and early 50s, suddenly people had a rolling bedroom, for God's sakes, and they had motels to stop in. The plow really changed the way we court about 5,000 BC. I mean, that was, you know, in hunting and gathering societies, women were very powerful. I mean, they commuted to work together, their fruits and vegetables. They came home with over 50% of the evening meal. And they were economically and socially and sexually powerful. So they were very easily chose partners and left relationships that didn't work for them. But when we settled down and got the plow, we began to have to marry for life.
Helen is an expert on love. She is well known for that work. So 15 years ago, when Match.com was coming up with their questionnaire for their users, they reached out to her.
So my first big job with them was trying to answer, why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? And for me, that was even more complicated than my brain studies.
So let's start there. Why do we fall in love with somebody or anybody, really?
There's two parts of your personality. There's your culture, everything you grew up to believe, do, say, and think. And there's your temperament, all your biological predispositions. We tend to fall for somebody from the same socioeconomic background, same ethnic background, same general level of intelligence, good looks, education, somebody with the same religious and social values, same with somebody with the same economic and reproductive goals. But you can walk into a room and everybody is from your background and level of intelligence and good looks, etc., and you don't fall in love with all of them.
The missing ingredient, Helen says, is what we might call chemistry.
You know, people say we have chemistry or we don't have chemistry. What do they mean by that? Could we be naturally drawn to some people rather than others?
She began to look at the hormones and neurotransmitters in our brains.
The dopamine, serotonin, testosterone, and estrogen system.
And Helen says each one of these systems comes with distinct personality traits.
People who are very expressive of the traits in the dopamine system, I call them explorers. They tend to be novelty-seeking, risk-taking,
curious, creative,
spontaneous, energetic, and mentally flexible. And they're drawn to people like themselves. They want somebody who's going to leap off the couch and go to the opera without a ticket and see if they can get in.
People who are heavy on serotonin traits,
I call them builders. This is really the opposite. They're traditional, conventional, calm. They like rules and schedules and plans. They think concretely rather than theoretically. And they tend to be more religious. So these people are also drawn to people like themselves.
And then there's the high testosterone type and the high estrogen type. They tend to be attracted to opposites. Helen says high testosterone people are leader types.
They tend to be analytical, logical, direct, decisive, tough-minded, skeptical, good at what we call rule-based systems. And the high estrogen, I call these people negotiators, they think broadly and contextually and long-term. They're very imaginative. They have very good people skills. They are really good at reading posture, gesture, tone of voice. They're intuitive. And they're what they call pro-social.
Helen used these general categories when she was working for Match.com. So you developed a questionnaire that then sort of matched people up, right, on Match.com.
It doesn't match you. It suggests people. It's what's interesting about these dating sites, including matches. They are not dating sites. So many academics have got that wrong. They're introducing sites. The only real algorithm is your own brain. Even your mother doesn't know everything about what's going to trigger that brain circuitry for romantic love. And generally, it's, you know, I mean, people want somebody who live in their city or town. They want somebody who's the right age, the right size, the right educational background, and that we can give you. But it's so interesting how many people don't understand this technology. It's so new that we haven't figured out how to use it. We're swiping, left, right, left, right. We're meeting so many people we can't remember what we did last night. And that's a mistake. That's not the way the brain is built.
Helen says our brain has a sweet spot. We can only deal with about 5 to 9 choices.
After you have 9 choices, you begin to get overloaded. It's called cognitive overload or the paradox of choice. So one of the things that I say is if you're going to be on the internet, go out and meet, not just talk on the internet, but meet 9 people so you can get your own algorithm going. And after you've met 9 people, stop. And get to know at least one of those people better.
Now, I reached out to Helen Fisher again because I wanted to ask her about the pandemic and how that was affecting people looking for love. I mean, it's difficult right now to go out and meet somebody you don't really know at a bar to see if there's really a connection. I thought social distancing would be putting a damper on online dating, but Helen said...
Actually, I think it's quite the reverse.
Oh.
What we're really seeing is a rise of a new stage in the courtship process. Prior to this pandemic, singles of all ages met on the internet and then went out and met in person. And now what we're seeing the rise of, a dramatic rise, of courting on the internet.
Before going out on that sometimes awkward first date, Helen says singles are spending hours on Zoom or FaceTime checking each other out. And she says that's a good development.
First of all, they got time to talk. I mean, even if they're working at home, they're not getting dressed, they're not commuting to work, they're not meeting friends and family after work. They have time to court. They not only have time to court, but when they meet somebody online, they have something meaningful to talk about. You know, an awful lot of first dates are basically chit-chat. And now what they're doing is self-disclosure, saying how you feel, your disappointments, feeling trapped, hoping for something, what you're going to do afterwards is very meaningful. It builds a partnership faster. It brings intimacy to the relationship faster. So they got time to date. They got something to talk about. They're doing more self-disclosure. And there's two very other important elements. One of them is sex is off the table. You know, when you go out and meet somebody without having ever seen them before or talked to them online, you have this sense, well, is he going to kiss me? Should I kiss her? Do we hold hands? Do I walk her to the bus? How do we handle the sex? It's off the table. The other thing that's off the table is money. They don't have to decide, well, are we going to go to a, you know, cheap coffee bar, and or are we going to go to a fancy restaurant? Who's going to pay? Do I offer to split the bill? It's gone. Sex is off the table. Money is off the table. I do think that this is a new stage in the courtship process. And I do think that after this pandemic is over, that stage will remain because people have gotten used to it. And because it saves time, it saves money, and you're going to kiss fewer frogs.
Helen Fisher is a biological anthropologist and a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute. Coming up, codependence in relationships.
The partners essentially cannot function, either physically, emotionally, mentally, cannot function without the other person.
Can you break the pattern? That's still to come.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia, with over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies. Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable, quality health care for everyone.
I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the science of love. When people are in unhealthy or unbalanced relationships, we often use a term to describe them, codependent.
They don't know where they end and others begin.
They tend to lose sight of their own thoughts and feelings, and they end up doing a lot of caretaking.
Your partner is your everything, your best friend, the only person you can talk to, your entire system.
Codependents believe if they're loved, then they're lovable.
I'm always adapting myself. I'm always modifying myself like a chameleon.
Codependency is not an official mental health condition. It's not in the big diagnostic handbook, the DSM. But still, relationship therapists use it all the time. Best-selling self-help books have been written about it. There are 12-step support groups for codependency. What does it really mean? Steph Yin decided to investigate, and for Steph, this is personal.
I fall hard into relationships. I'm all in. I'm a caretaker, a people pleaser, and I hate conflict. I've had sleepless nights tending to the other person's feelings. I've fallen behind on work and school, determined to fix my partner's life problems. And I've taken on someone else's interests, opinions, and friends, wearing them like a suit. After breaking up, I'd have to go through a process of stripping down and rediscovering my own preferences. Over the years, relationships have come and gone, but friends, partners, and therapists have continued to tell me that I struggle with codependency. Still, I never felt I had a super firm grasp on what that meant, where it came from, and what I could do about it. So I did some digging. The concept of codependency emerged in the 40s and 50s. Therapists were trying to understand how families and entrenched relationship dynamics shaped people's mental health, particularly around addiction. Darlene Lancer, a marriage and family therapist in California who wrote Codependency for Dummies, says codependency is often instilled early on. Here's one idea of it.
Codependents are alienated from their true self through wounding that occurs in childhood.
Children come to believe that their value comes not from within, but from how others see them.
Your focus is like outside of you. So it's something external to you rather than being aware and attending to your inner loneliness and emptiness or sadness or anger or whatever the feelings might be, and being able to comfort yourself and meet your needs and ask for what you want.
This can happen many ways. For instance, with children of people who struggle with substance abuse, mental health conditions, or chronic illness, early on, children learn that their value is in being a caretaker or in keeping things together. Also, children with parents or guardians who are emotionally absent or rigid and controlling. A father doesn't like that his son cries a lot and likes to write poetry. That kid learns to suppress his feelings, to hide parts of himself, to be accepted.
And then as an adult, you can't identify your feelings. And then the gap between who you really are, I call your true self, and what you show the world, it gets wider and wider.
So in the beginning, codependency is actually a survival skill. But over time, it becomes a problem. And by adulthood, the programming can be lodged deep in, particularly when it's a response to trauma. You might have heard of fight, flight, and freeze as automatic responses to trauma. Some theorists have added a fourth F, fawn, extreme people-pleasing or submission, as a way to ease stressful situations. But not everyone agrees with describing codependency just in terms of pathology. Some say codependency has a lot to do with the cultural conditioning we receive. For instance, think about how we portray romantic love. We're told love is about finding that soulmate who completes you in every way.
Romantic love has almost been turned into this thing where your partner is expected to meet all of your needs.
That's Joy Harden Bradford, a therapist in Georgia.
When really that's impossible, like no one person can be everything for someone else.
Joy says this messaging is all over pop culture, in movies. Take Twilight, for instance.
Your scent, it's like a drug to me. Like my own personal brand of heroin.
Or A Star is Born.
And whatever you want is okay.
Whatever I want, but I want to be with you.
I know. I just want you to be happy.
People swooned over these films. They were presented as a romantic ideal, but both featured very toxic codependent relationships. Also, music. A codependency playlist might contain songs like,
I'd still do anything for you. I'll play your game. If you want to, I can save you. And tell me now, how do I live without you? I want to know, how do I
catch a grenade for you? Throw my hand on a blade.
Okay, to be fair, it's not just pop culture that's setting us up. It's our brain chemicals, too. That roller coaster fueled by dopamine, serotonin, and butterflies, it feels so good. And that's why it can be really hard to suss out codependency early on in a relationship. A few therapists told me they don't even bother to look for codependency in the first year or so of a relationship because it looks like the initial stages of falling in love, of wanting to merge with another person. Sean Byrne, a psychologist in California, says in a healthy relationship, the goal is interdependence rather than codependence. Think of it like a Venn diagram, two circles with a bit of overlap. That's good. You want there to be mutual caretaking and sharing within the relationship. But there's also a significant part of each circle that's independent, meaning the partners still have their own lives, their unique interests, relationships, and activities.
There's autonomy yet connectedness.
Put another way, healthy love should make each person's life bigger. But in a codependent relationship, lives can shrink down to just what's shared in the relationship. Partners become highly enmeshed, even though at first they were likely attracted to each other's individuality.
Oh, I love the way that person does this and their hobbies that they have and the beliefs and values that they have.
That's Chloe Cook, a couples therapist in Atlanta. Chloe says over time,
you stop doing the things that you did when you were single. We start depending on the other person to build our self-esteem.
So what can you do if you think you're codependent? Well, first, know that it's common. It probably exists to varying degrees in every relationship. And maybe don't obsess over the label. Here's Keisha Sullivan, a therapist in Florida.
For me personally, I don't like that term because what happens is when you label me, that defines me, and then I over-identify with it and I can't see my way out of it.
For Keisha, getting over codependency is all about getting over our automatic programming. She says codependency happens like an instinct. That's why people who've struggled with it for a long time find themselves in the same cycles again and again. To fight it, you have to make it conscious.
That will always be enacted until a different way is learned and there's a recognition of what's gone on for you.
So the next step is readiness to change, which Keisha acknowledges can be hard. Try journaling. Fortify yourself by writing down how codependency interferes with your goals or your health. Because codependent people often suppress their emotions, it can also be helpful to make a practice of noticing your feelings. Here's Misty Hook, a therapist in Texas.
Stop at various times during the day and just check in. How am I feeling? Am I anxious? Am I happy? Am I mad?
Next time someone asks you what you want for dinner, if you have a habit of automatically saying, I don't care, what do you want? Stop and check in with yourself. What do you actually want? And try naming it. Or set aside 15 minutes a day to spontaneously do something you want to do. Get ice cream, sit outside, dance to some music. Of course, one word kept coming up again and again, boundaries. Boundaries can be tricky. Here's Dedeker Winston, relationship coach and co-host of the Polyamory podcast, which explores all types of romantic relationships.
A boundary is something that you yourself put in place for yourself and by yourself to protect yourself in a situation. And now you'll notice I repeated the word self a whole lot because I think that's the most important part with boundaries is that this is about essentially rules or limits you have put on your own behavior that protect you.
That means you don't just say your boundary and rely on the other person to change their behavior. It's on you to enforce it. Darlene Lancer, author of Codependency for Dummies, says knowing your feelings and boundaries leads to more intimate communication between partners. When you're talking, try to be vulnerable. And when you're listening, try to be curious.
And that's what keeps relationships alive. The aliveness comes from the authenticity.
To be authentic with others, you first have to be authentic with yourself. You have to know yourself, value yourself, and express yourself. And know that you'll be okay because you have what you need.
When you please and you try to adapt, this gap between your real self and who you want to present to the world grows wider and wider. It's almost like imagine Pinocchio growing a nose every time he lies, okay? And when you do the opposite, when you're authentic, even when it's uncomfortable, you grow your real self. It ignites all your inner power. Your soul is very powerful, but it needs to be expressed and come into the world and not be hiding.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.